Dirty Bird Podcast contains foul language and is not appropriate for young fledglings. Listener discretion is advised. Our intro music is brought to you by Ricky Pistone, aka Dick Piston. And our outro music is brought to you by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music.
Are you looking for a podcast today? With ornithology and humor you crave. Well, I know all these guys and it's birds they like. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're just a couple guys who really like birds. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're pretty dirty, but they really like birds.
Hello, and welcome to Dirty Bird Podcast, a podcast that's serious about birds, but nothing else. I'm Dr. John, and in each episode, I pick an individual bird species and tell you everything you need to know about it. Very excited about this episode. It's about the cedar waxwing. I'm, like, really excited about this episode because I love these birds. They are so cool. Not only do they look beautiful, but there's some really interesting research that's been done on them. Everything from about them getting drunk. Yes, that's right. Birds sometimes party hard. to invasive plants that are changing the way that these birds look. Thanks to Diana for suggesting this episode. I gave Diana a shout out in my last episode. She suggested I do this after she watched cedar waxwings in the berry trees around her neighborhood. And I'm recording today from First Landing State Park as usual. You probably hear the raindrops. It's a little bit of a rainy day, kind of off and on rain. I'm hoping it stops so that my recording equipment is safe and I don't get rained out. The one good thing about the rain is it seems to be keeping the humans away and all the human noise. And you might be able to hear, but the birds don't care. They are chirping all around. There's some chickadees around right now. So hopefully the rain keeps it mild and the birds keep it wild. This episode will probably be a little bit on the long side. There was so much information about cedar waxwings for me to read. So apparently these birds do pretty well in captivity. So they've been researched a lot in laboratory conditions. And they're a pretty chill bird. They're not very aggressive or territorial or skittish. So they tolerate the human presence pretty well. So there's a lot of observations in the wild of these birds too. So that means I poured through a lot of scientific articles about these birds, but I pulled out the best facts for you guys, and let's learn about the life history of the cedar waxwing. So I'll start off with their description. You know, these birds, they are absolutely gorgeous and so much fun to watch. Another great thing about them is they are a flocking species, so where you see one, you're gonna see a lot of them. I remember my first time actually seeing a cedar waxwing was when I was in West Virginia in medical school on the West Virginia State Fairgrounds in Lewisburg. I like to kind of bird watch there and walk around. And I remember hearing a lot of bird noise and looking up in a canopy, and there was probably a flock of, I don't know, like 30, 40 cedar waxwings. And it was just a joy watching, you know, each and every single one of them as they gobbled up some, you know, fruit or berries or whatever they were doing. So this bird is like a little bit smaller than a northern cardinal, and has a very similar appearance because it has a crest on its head like a northern cardinal does. It has a black bill and black on its face, almost like a little black mask, and kind of a black line that runs from the back of its eyes. Its overall color is kind of a gray, maybe reddish tinted gray over its body, with some darker gray and black on the wings. And they get their common name, waxwing, from a thick, stuck-on red pigment that they have on their secondary wing feathers, specifically on the tips of 9 of their wing feathers. It literally looks like their wings were dipped in, you know, red ink, like, you know, the ink you would use to, like, seal a letter in medieval times or something. I'm going to talk about the chemical composition of this amazing substance later on in the show and how it gets its color. Both of the sexes have the red coloration on their wings, but generally young birds do not have it. Also, a few birds within the flock may not have it at all for unknown reasons. More females than males seem to lack the red wax, and also males seem to have more feathers with waxy tips than females do. Older birds also appear to have more red wax tips than younger birds. And as if that, you know, red, waxy on the wingtips is not beautiful enough, they also have bright yellow feathers on the tips of their tail. Like, there's kind of like a yellow bar that runs across the tip of their tail. And these are all great field markers. You know, often they're up in the canopy of trees, so they're a little hard to see. As we'll talk about with their vocalizations, you know, they are... you know, a little nondescript, but once you get them in the binoculars and you see that red on their wingtip, or you see that yellow bar across the tail, I mean, it's unmistakable. You know you're looking at a waxwing. They have a really broad range across North America. So they breed in southern Canada and northern America, pretty much all the way across. But they migrate for the non-breeding season down throughout the U.S., down into Mexico and Central America. They may even go down as far as Panama and some of the Caribbean islands. They are a highly nomadic species, so within their range, they are moving around all the time. And we'll talk about why this is later. They are mainly fruit-eating birds, so basically they show up in an area, clear out all the fruit they can, and then move on to the next place. They're like, I don't know, Attila the Hun of fruit in the bird world. They show up, pillage all the fruit, and then move on. So we already talked about their common name, cedar waxwing. You know, waxwing, you know, we talked about it. It's because of the red wax tips of their wings, and then cedar, because they love eating cedar berries, as we'll talk about. Their scientific name is Bombacilla cedrorum. So Bombacilla, this is a great word. I love to say it. Bombacilla. this genus also contains the Bohemian and the Japanese waxwing. Those are the two other waxwing species. Our cedar waxwing is closely related to these. Let me break this name down into its Greek and Latin. So bombax is ancient Greek for silk, and cilla in Latin means tail. So the genus name literally means silk tail. They apparently, you know, have some really silky feel to their feathers. So I guess like early taxonomists, you know, that like, you know, collected these birds and were naming them, felt the really silky feathers compared to other birds and so named them this. And actually the person who did, you know, name this bird was a physician, naturalist, and theologian named Caspar Schwenkfeld. He published a book on the natural history of Silesia. This is a region in modern-day Germany and Poland. And he was studying the Bohemian waxwing, ranges across there. And he named the Bohemian waxwing Seidenschwanz, which means silk tail in German. So this genus name is literally just a Greek-Latin translation of that German name. I'm not going to lie, brought in that history just so I could pronounce some German names. They're kind of fun to say. That species name, cedrorum, you can probably already tell what it means. It's just Latin for of the cedars. So the full scientific name of this bird, Bombacilla cedrorum, means silktail of the cedars. That sort of sounds cool. Silktail of the cedars. It kind of sounds like a magical item you'd find in a video game. There's not much to talk about with the vocalizations of these birds. They're not songbirds, so they don't have a song that they use. Instead, they just kind of give calls. They're highly flocking birds. You know, they're always found together, so they're always giving kind of calls, communicating with each other. They have two calls. One is a high-pitched Z call. And the other one is called a sighing whistle. So you'll hear these often when they're feeding, communicating with each other, and also when they're in flight. So like I said, these birds are fruit-eating specialists. So when you're a fruit eater, that's termed a frugivore. Fruits with high sugar content are especially important for them. Some favorite fruits are crab apples, hawthorns, cedar berries, of course, cedar waxwing, cherries, blueberries, dogwood berries, and mistletoe berries. Experiments have shown that they select red fruits over green fruits. This is no surprise. Green berries are generally unripened, and red signifies ripeness. They also seem to prefer small, easily manipulable fruits like berries. Laboratory experiments have shown that they seem to prefer eastern red cedar, yaupon holly, and Chinese holly the best when compared with other fruits. They seem to really hate Chinese Jupiter berries, probably because they are not only large and waxy, but also green. Green is gross. I almost think of cedar waxwings like little children turning up their noses at green Brussels sprouts or broccoli. Like, no, gross. They don't strictly stick to this color preference, though. They are highly adaptable and will adjust their fruit selection based on how much sugar they taste and how much nutrition that the different fruit provides. That's right, they taste sugar. These birds have quite the sweet tooth, or sweet bill, I guess. They can't seem to differentiate between the three sugar types, though, so they can't tell glucose, fructose, or sucrose from each other. This is important because while they can digest sucrose, unlike some birds like European starlings that can't digest it at all, they can digest sucrose, but it's just really inefficient, and it just kind of passes right through them. This leads to their blood sugar remaining low, even though they've just spent all that time and energy, you know, feeding on the sucrose berries. And while they can't taste, you know, the difference, they probably feel the difference. They probably get a little bit of a bellyache from eating the poorly digestible sucrose. And so that's probably how they learn to avoid fruits that contain sucrose. It's almost like someone who's lactose intolerant. You know, you learn pretty quickly to stay away from those because you get a tummy ache. Instead, they prefer the hexose sugars, fructose and glucose. The hexagonal ring molecular structure of these sugars is easy for them to digest and absorb. Waxwings are able to absorb about 90% of the hexose sugars that they consume, but only 60% of the sucrose that they consume. If fructose and glucose aren't available, waxwings will just compensate by eating a lot of sucrose-containing fruits, producing a whole lot of shit in the process. Even without sucrose, these birds shit pretty quickly after eating. I found a cool study that basically did a barium swallow study on cedar waxwings. So barium swallow studies, like I do these on patients all the time. You have them drink like a benign radioactive material, and then it passes through their GI tract, and you like use an x-ray to like literally watch it travel through their GI tract and look for like abnormalities. So this study did this with cedar waxwings and found that within 10 minutes, waxwings were already shitting out 30 to 40% of what they ate. So it moved pretty quick. And this makes me think of a funny story. I'm such a bird nerd. So yeah, one time I met this guy at a bar, and of course I started talking about birds, and it turns out that he had a really interesting bird story he was telling me. So apparently he was kind of in like a fight with his neighbor. His, you know, who knows, you know, him and his neighbor were kind of going at it. I don't know, about a fence or something like that. But apparently his neighbor had a really nice car in his driveway. So, and it's like his prized possession. He was out there waxing it and washing it all the time. So this guy, he bought some berry trees and planted them in his yard, and cedar waxwings would come and eat the berries from the trees and then fly right over the neighbor's yard and just shit all over his prized car. Apparently it's like purple berries are just shitting it all over. The neighbor's like losing his mind, washing his car every day. Oh, that is some petty revenge right there. Experiments have also shown that waxwings can remember the location that sugar-rich containing foods are found in. This is independent of sight cues like color. They actually remember the physical location, you know, the same way like nuthatches remember where they stored seeds. So they will return to the spots where they previously have found a sweet snack to look for fruit again. Studies with captive cedar waxwings have shown they need about 1,000 kilojoules a day to survive. The sugars they consume yield about 16.7 kilojoules a gram. And so when you do that math, that means they need to consume a little over 5 grams of pure sugar a day. Compared to our human diets, five grams of sugar is nothing. That's how much sugar you'll find in just one of those like sugar packets you might put in your coffee. But in nature, you know, sugar is much more rare. A single blueberry contains about 1 kilojoule of sugar, meaning a waxwing would have to eat a little over 100 blueberries a day to survive. It takes a lot of time and energy to find 100 blueberries in the wild. And blueberries are pretty much all fructose and glucose. So, you know, remember, those are the sugars that the waxwings absorb really well. But say the waxwings are in an area that contains mostly sucrose fruits, which they are only able to absorb about 60% of the sugar from. This means that the birds would quickly go into a spiral where, even though they are spending all their time eating berries and eating fruits, they're not absorbing enough sugar to survive. And I just want to pause for a second and comment on, you know, a bird that eats almost entirely fruit. This is pretty crazy because it's very rare in the bird world that you're able to survive on just fruit. I found an experiment out of Europe, one of those like early 20th century experiments where they didn't really care about ethical issues for animals. Basically, they took a bunch of different species of birds and fed them nothing but fruits. The only bird species that didn't end up dying of starvation was the Bohemian waxwing, a close cousin of our cedar waxwing. So just the fact that they can survive on solely fruits is a marvel. And, you know, each individual berry, each individual fruit that they eat, it doesn't yield a ton of energy and passes through their system really quick. You know, these are birds. They need to fly. They can't spend the time to digest something for a long time the way us mammals do. So basically, waxwings are just consuming and shitting out huge amounts of fruit and seeds. Shitting out all these seeds, this makes them a really important dispersal for berry bushes and for fruiting seed trees. They rely on them. They do have certain fruit preferences, and so if they show up to an area that has a certain fruit or berry that they prefer, they will consume it all until it's gone, and then move on to lesser desirable fruits, or they'll just move on to feed in a new area. Mistletoe and hackberries appear to be some of their favorites, followed by hollyberries. Their esophagus is highly expandable, so even once their intestines are sort of backed up with all the fruit that they ate, they will just hold a bunch of berries in their throat until they've shit out some more fruit and made some room, and then they'll just, like, move forward. It's like an assembly line in their digestive tract for processing fruits. Well, the rain seems to have slacked off. Fingers crossed, I can even see some sun poking through. The birds are being, you know, just as rambunctious as usual. The rain didn't faze them at all, but I'm certainly glad that it passed. It helps me hear the bird calls a little better, too. It's pretty beautiful out here right now. We've gotten a lot of rain. You know, I'm recording this in early March. The swamp is very swampy. This little, you know, island that I kind of record on, it's barely even an island anymore. I literally have my boots kind of in the water while I'm recording. Okay, so back to cedar waxwings. So, you know, mistletoe and hackberries, like I said, they're some of their favorite foods. These berries are usually found up in the canopy of trees, and experiments have shown that waxwings seem to prefer fruits that they can find high up in trees. Likely because this offers them a good vantage point to look out for predators while they feed. I found a really interesting story out of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, where basically this guy named Mark Whitmer noticed that cedar waxwings will often jump back and forth from feeding on the berries of Viburnum opulum, also known as snowball tree or guelder rose, and the flowers called catkins of the eastern cottonwood tree. He wondered if maybe there was some reason why they seemed to be eating both these berries and flowers in combination. Like, basically, they would, like, eat a berry and then chase it with some catkin. Experiments found that when fed exclusively the opulum berries or only the cottonwood catkins, cedar waxwings became malnourished. However, when fed both of these, they did great. Chemical analysis of the opulum berries showed that they contain a lot of sugar but also a lot of acid and not much protein. Cottonwood catkins are basically the opposite. They're not acidic and contain little sugar, but they do contain a lot of protein. He proposed that the birds were eating these in combination as sort of a feeding mutualism, using the basic and protein-rich catkins to sort of buffer the acid content of the opulum berries and provide much-needed protein. This is so cool because the waxwings, you know, they just know, or I guess they learned to do this. While Viburnum opulum is actually an invasive species, it does have a relative called Viburnum trilobum. This is known as highbush cranberry, and it likely has a similar mutualistic feeding role with waxwings. So this may be like an ancient behavior that they evolved to learn. While they do love their fruits, cedar waxwings are not strict frugivores. They will eat insects such as mayflies and swarming ants to supplement their diets. When they capture insects, they do so in the manner similar to a kingbird. They'll swoop down from a perch position and pluck them out of the air. They will also eat flowers if they are unable to find enough fruit. And they are very rarely carnivorous. I found an account from 1992 in Massachusetts where a cedar waxwing was observed perched on a branch with an eviscerated bird nestling in its mouth. It then proceeded to consume the nestling whole in 3 swallows. This was unlikely a nestling that it stole from another bird's nest, the way, you know, like blue jays do. More likely it was committing infanticide on a sick or weak nestling, or disposing of a dead nestling. Dead nestlings can spread disease, or if, you know, you just throw them on the ground, then that might attract predators to the nest. So eating it may have been a good, survival strategy to save the rest of the nest and also to not waste any resources. I'll just remark, you know, when I was reading this, all I can think of is, like, there's still a little bit of dinosaur DNA, you know, in birds that causes them, you know, even the most strictly frugivorous, you know, fruit-eating hippie bird, like, still will resort to a little bit of carnivorous dinosaur-like behavior on occasion. Like, you know, just check out my Titmouse and Chickadee episode, Nice Tits. I think it's like my second or third episode. You know, just check that out to learn how, you know, the seemingly little puffball cute birds can really be vicious little flying velociraptors when there's meat on the menu. So let's loop back to talking about those amazing red waxy feather tips on these birds and how they relate to their food. So, chemical analysis shows that these waxy red tips are composed of a pigment chemical called astaxanthin. You might recognize that if you're a true bird nerd, a true dirty bird nerd. I talk about astaxanthin in my Northern Flicker episode, my Roseate Spoonbill episode, I mentioned in my Cardinal episode. Is it pigment a lot of bird species use to produce red in their feathers? Astaxanthin comes naturally from fruit-heavy diets of these birds. There's also another pigment chemical they might come across in their diet, though, that changes up their coloration. Not all cedar waxwings have those yellow-tipped tail feathers I talked about earlier. Since the 1950s, more and more have been spotted with orange coloration on their tail, an orange band across their tail instead of a yellow band. This is due to another red carotid pigment called rhodoxanthin that is present in an invasive species of plant called Morrow's honeysuckle. This plant was sold at nurseries starting in the 1950s as an ornamental plant, but its berries soon got spread far and wide by birds. The main pigment in cedar waxwings' yellow tail tips is normally a pigment called canary xanthophyll, but when they consume Morrow's honeysuckle, they also incorporate in rhodoxanthin, resulting in an orange color. It appears this pops up more in juvenile than adult cedar waxwings. Kind of an unclear reason, but some of the stuff I saw proposed for why is that juveniles might be outcompeted for the native plants, so they have to eat the Morrow's honeysuckle, which, you know, is invasive and a little less familiar. Also, juveniles are undergoing rapid growth, so they just might incorporate the rhodoxanthin in more to their tail feathers. There's also rare instances where those red waxy tips will be yellow instead of red. I couldn't find the exact study into this. I don't know if anybody has actually, like,
captured a cedar waxwing with the yellow waxy tips and chemically analyzed it. But I suspect it's a similar mechanism to the mutation that causes northern cardinals to sometimes be yellow. This is due to a genetic mutation that inhibits the birds from converting the yellow carotenoids into red ones. I talk about this a lot in my cardinal episode, so I won't talk about it here. Check out my cardinal episode. Let me know what you think. I've heard from some people that the sound quality is not great. So if you really want me to, I'll re-record it. just let me know. I'll end this feeding section with probably the most interesting fact about these birds, that they somewhat regularly get drunk. And I'm not talking just like buzz. Like, sometimes they get so drunk that they can't fly, or so drunk that they like fly erratically and end up crashing into things, sometimes even dying. I really shouldn't be laughing here. You know, bird death is terrible, but I don't know, something about blackout birds I just find hilarious. Like, you know, reading about these birds, like, they're pretty sociable. You know, they like to hang out. They don't have a lot of fear of humans. They get drunk. Like, I just can't help but think they're like the Dionysus, you know, the Greek god of wine and parties, or Bacchus, you know, if you're a Roman, I guess. They're just like, they like to party. These birds like to party. So, I don't know. It's just a funny image, and I'm definitely anthropomorphizing here, because I'm sure these birds don't actually like to get drunk. It's more of an accident, as we'll find out. Waxwings aren't the only ones that this happens to. It does happen to robins, too, because they eat a lot of fruit also. But, I mean, you know, waxwings, they're a fruit and berry specialist, so they're just kind of more prone to it. Basically, what happens here is fruit ferments. The sugars in the fruit ferment, and they form alcohol. I mean, you know, you've all heard of prison hooch. This is basically the same thing. The intoxication that they get can range from them just being a little extra noisy and clumsy to them having difficulty flying. And even to them falling on the ground, crashing into trees and objects and windows. And while this is a kind of like anecdotal story that's been going on for a while, there are a couple papers that actually, you know, document this and collected specimens and proved that it is alcohol intoxication going on. So two such cedar waxwings suffered fatal injuries from intoxication in Indiana, where they and their flock got a little too drunk on fermented hawthorn berries. While the rest of the flock was able to stagger off, these two birds crashed into objects so hard that they had fatal pericardial hemorrhages. Basically, blood pooled up in the sac that their heart is in. So, you know, then the heart can't beat and you die. Testing of these birds' livers found 238 and 998 parts per million of ethanol, respectively. I did some rough math, which I hope is right. It might not be, but this is equal to a blood alcohol content of around 0.02 or 0.09. You know, this isn't a lot for us humans, and us humans, 0.08 alcohol level is considered drunk driving. But, you know, us humans, we've sort of evolved alongside alcohol for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. Birds, they never evolved to drink alcohol the way us humans do. Their livers don't really know how to process it. So even while it may seem like mild drunkenness to us humans, it's probably like straight blackout drunk for them. And yeah, so then it results in a, I don't know, drunk flying accident. I looked into kind of the exact science behind this on how these wild fruits ferment. So it basically only happens during a narrow time frame in the late winter or early spring, where the fruits have been largely frozen all winter long, and then they begin to thaw. This allows yeast to start breaking down the glucose into pyruvate, and then the pyruvate into ethanol. This ethanol doesn't stick around for very long, though, because bacteria will then break it down into acetic acid, just like how wine will turn into vinegar if you leave it for too long. So it's really a very narrow time that this happens, and it's almost certainly accidental. I mean, there's no way these birds want to get drunk. I mean, no animal wants to be, intoxicated in the wild, because that puts you at risk for all kinds of bad things happening to you. And so, you know, this case was with hawthorn berries. I also found a documented account of them becoming drunk on Brazilian pepper tree berries. And then anecdotally, there's lots of other accounts of them becoming drunk on a variety of other berries and fruits. A lot of crows today. A lot of crow activity. A lot of cardinals, too. In fact, I saw a male and female cardinal kind of flying around not too long ago, and I can hear that male cardinal calling. So let's talk about the breeding of these birds. They are very non-territorial. In fact, they seem to be some of the most peaceful birds I've studied so far. You know, when you see starlings and grackles in groups, they're always squabbling and pecking at each other. Cedar waxwings are very harmonious. You know, they're just here to eat fruit. You know, maybe they get a little drunk. They're just having a good time. Their courtship and breeding is very similar to this, too. They perform their courtship within the flock. I think this is a kind of funny. Again, I'm anthropomorphizing, but it's almost like they're at a big mixer party. You know, everyone's mingling and hanging out together, but still trying to find their special someone. They have a very prolonged courtship period. As we'll talk about, they're very late breeders. So pretty much throughout the whole spring and summer, they are performing their courtship with each other. And they still continue to do courtship rituals even while incubating their eggs, based on accounts that I read. Their courtship display involves them passing back and forth a berry or flower or a leaf. You know, this is pretty common in the bird world. We see where the male will offer the female a food item, you know, sort of like demonstrating his value, I guess. But, you know, they'll like pass it back and forth. You know, you take it. No, you take it. No, you. sometimes they'll also rub their bills together, too. They flutter their wings, just kind of, you know, showing that they like each other. The waxy tips on their wings may serve as a courtship tool, as a sign of maturity. Remember how I mentioned earlier, older individuals tend to have more waxy wingtips. This has never really been proven in experiments. This is kind of anecdotal from what I was reading. You know, this whole courtship thing about more wax on your wingtip, you know, may be like a cue like, oh, they're older, they're more successful, they're probably better at breeding. I like them. That's never been proven in experiments, but it's been hypothesized. They are very late nesters. Their egg laying doesn't even start until July. An active nest can be even found into early October. This is crazy because, you know, most birds have migrated south by, you know, August, October for sure. But, you know, the cedar waxwings are like, nah, we good. You know, we're just doing our nest. But like, this makes sense when you think about their diets. You know, they're fruit specialists. So just like insect specialist birds try to time their breeding to peaks in insect populations, these frugivores try to time their breeding to late summer and early fall when lots of fruits are ripening. Their nest is like a lot of songbird nests. It's tight woven together sticks with a soft inner layer of grasses. They may incorporate scraps of paper into their nests. And I've seen the shape of their nest described as a teacup. The male and female will build the nest together. It takes about a week for them to build it. One very studious observer reckoned it takes about 2,500 trips for cedar waxwings to successfully build their nest. That's a lot of time and energy. They do take some shortcuts, though, to accomplish this. They will steal material from old nests and even from nests of other birds that are actively under construction. Stealing material from old nests has its drawbacks. These nests are likely to contain ectoparasites, and waxwings that have employed old nest material into their current nests have been found to have high mite burdens. Of course, stealing from another bird's active nest also has its drawbacks. I mean, that bird, if it catches you stealing, it might attack you. They also sometimes use an old nest as a base to build their new nest on top of. They usually try to hide their nest among thickly vegetated areas of trees and rely on stealth to keep their nest safe from predators rather than, you know, actively defending it. They seem to really like hawthorn trees for nesting in, probably because they also provide a ready source of food. You know, once their eggs hatch, they can, you know, build their nest and just pluck a berry and feed it to their kids. They lay clutches of 3 to 5 eggs, And they're really pretty eggs. They're turquoise with black spots. The female does all the incubation with the male feeding her on the nest. It takes about 2 weeks for the eggs to hatch. It appears most of nest failure of cedar waxwings occurs during the incubation stage. One study from Canaan Valley in West Virginia found an overall 25% nest failure rate for cedar waxwings. I did find the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they cite that once the young are fledged, you know, meaning they've gotten their feathers and left the nest, they have a success rate of 72 to 87%. So, I mean, that sounds pretty good. But, you know, the West Virginia study found a fourth of all nests fail. I also found some observational studies that found nest failure rates averaging around 60%. That's really high. If they do survive the incubation stage, though, they hatch as sightless and completely naked pink nestlings. Males do most of the feeding of the nestlings. They mostly feed them fruit, but they will also bring them insects like caterpillars. Insects seem to make up a big part of the diet in the first 3 days of the nestling's life, likely because they need high protein content in order to grow. At about 5 days old, their eyes open and also their pin feathers begin to emerge. The parents appear to eat the fecal sacs from what I read from nest accounts. I've talked about fecal sacs on the show a lot. They're basically the bird version of diapers, membranous sacs of bird poop that are easy for parent birds to carry off or, in some cases, eat. This helps prevent predators from following a trail of poop to the nest. They grow rapidly, and by about 18 days of age, they are ready to leave the nest. The parents will continue to feed the newly fledged birds for at least a week after they've left the nest. They will sometimes do double broods, although this seems to be the exception, not the rule. And usually it's only older, more experienced birds that can do this. The birds with, you know, lots of waxy tips on their wings. They're the old guard. Now this makes me think that these waxy tips are almost like badges, like in the military. You know, you see these old generals with badges all across their chest, like, I guess, wax wings. You know, the more wax you got on your wing, the more old and experienced you are.
Got some red-bellied woodpeckers right overhead. So, talking about, you know, predators and the populations of these birds. So, predators of waxwings include the usual songbird predators, falcons, hawks, mammals. They also sometimes die in confrontational interactions with larger songbirds like mockingbirds. I found a really interesting predator account from 2009 in Nacogdoches, Texas, where a blue jay was observed pinning a cedar waxwing to the ground and pecking it to death and then eating its head. This is really abnormal, though. Like, blue jays aren't routinely going after waxwings. Who knows? That waxwing could have been drunk and the, you know, blue jay was just being an opportunistic predator. But blue jays are major predators of waxwing eggs and nestlings, along with the typical nest raiders like crows. They can also be victims of disease. I found an account from 1968 in Ohio where 24 cedar waxwings were found to have died from Pastorella multiexida. This is the bacteria that causes avian cholera. As far as their interactions with humans, they have a bad historical relationship with farmers because they damage fruit crops. They don't just damage crops by directly eating the fruits. Flocks of these birds are sort of, you know, party animals. They descend on a berry bush or a strawberry patch, and they are often destructive, breaking small branches with their body weight, knocking fruits to the ground. Remember how I talked earlier about how they, you know, eat the high sugar fruits that they can find, and so they'll kind of like taste them. So basically what they do is they'll sample food a lot. So they'll peck a small portion of fruit and kind of decide whether it's worth their time to eat the full thing. This results in them ruining a lot of crops even without eating the whole thing. They'll just like go through the like peck little bites like, nah, don't like it. They're like the Goldilocks of the bird world. not enough sugar. Oh, no, too much sucrose. In Florida, as much as 17 to 75% of blueberry crop in a season is attributed to be lost to birds, with most of this coming from cedar waxwings. Farmers use a variety of ways to try to prevent this. Pyrotechnics, sound harassment, nets are all used to, you know, keep the waxwings away. The most effective means of deterrent, apparently, though, is setting up kestrel boxes and enticing these falconiforms to become guard birds, basically, for their fruit batches. I actually really love this. Like, this is so cool. You're, you know, helping prevent a pest. Pest, we say, but, you know, the waxwings are just, you know, living their life. But you're preventing it by fostering another bird species. You're helping foster kestrels on your property to help prevent the waxwings from coming there. It's great. You know, it's a win-win. You're helping out birds either way. Some farmers appear to actually like waxwings, though. Apples apparently are not, you know, super big on the waxwing menu. I think like domestic, you know, apples, not crab apples, because I saw those were some of the top fruits that waxwings like. But, you know, the big apples we buy in the grocery store, they're just too big for waxwings to eat efficiently. And also they have a high sucrose content, so waxwings don't really like them. Instead of eating the apples, waxwings will eat worms that would otherwise burrow into and ruin the apples. So there's like anecdotal stuff that I've seen that, you know, if a waxwing flock comes through your apple orchard, it means that you're going to have a good harvest. Mortality rates appear to be pretty high in cedar waxwings. One estimate I saw from the U.S. Department of Agriculture was that they have a 55% annual death rate, basically meaning a cedar waxwing, you know, it has a little less than a 50% chance of making it through each year alive. And that figure doesn't seem to change based on their age or sex. Young ones are just as likely to die as old ones. You know, that's a pretty high death rate, and kind of seems like they wouldn't really be able to, you know, keep up with their numbers based on that. Pesticides may be detrimental to waxwings. I found a study from 1968 to 1969 that was conducted in Emmett County, Michigan, where a researcher collected and studied waxwing eggs across that county. He found that eggs coming from nests in trees, in orchards, or near farms had significantly greater rates of sterility and embryo death, close to 50% of all eggs studied. While this is just correlation and not causation, it may be that the pesticides used on the farm were responsible for this. This researcher also interestingly went back to museum collections of cedar waxwing eggs from the 1920s prior to DDT being used, and unsurprisingly, he found that those eggshells were thicker compared to the 1960s eggshells that likely had been thinned from DDT. I also found a really unfortunate case from 1935 in Los Angeles, California, where nearly an entire flock of cedar waxwings died from internal hemorrhage after ingesting dates. Autopsy determined that cyanide poisoning had killed the waxwings. I also found an account where several cedar waxwings died from cyanide poisoning after consuming large quantities of berries from the invasive heavenly bamboo plant. It appears some plants, especially invasive species it seems, can naturally produce cyanide, often after being exposed to drought or frost conditions. This is another argument to plant native species, people. Even though these ornamental plants look pretty, their berries might be deadly to wildlife. There's a lot of toxins in berries and fruit, actually. You know, like, think about, I don't know, at least I was the kid that, you know, I would see, like, a bright red berry and be like, ooh, can I eat this, Mom? They're like, no. But then I would see the birds eating it, and I'm like, why can the birds eat it and I can't? this is generally because, you know, birds can eat these berries, but that would be toxic to mammals because birds have short digestive tracts and they'll just shit out the toxins before they avoid them. Whereas, you know, us mammals, we got slow digestive tracts, we would absorb it. Waxwings are further adapted for these toxins by having a liver that is proportionally large for a bird, making up about 5% of their total body mass. The oldest known cedar waxwing was 7 years old. Which is kind of young. I mean, most birds like that I've you know, done on this show, like small songbirds, they usually like 10 years is like, you know, the max. So the fact they only found one that was 7 years old as the max oldest is, I don't know. I guess they do have a high mortality rate. Maybe because they get drunk so much. Their population appears stable, except in the northern part of their range, where they are experiencing a small decline of about 2 to 4%, studied between 1966 and 2013. Their current breeding population is estimated at 64 million. I'll close out this section with an anecdote I didn't really know where to fit elsewhere in the show, so I saved it for here. But I stumbled across a pretty amazing story where a cedar waxwing seemed to fall in love with its own reflection. In 1964, in Nantucket, Massachusetts, a lady named Edith Andrews took care of a cedar waxwing for several days after it had injured its wing. The cedar waxwing made a full recovery, but when she went to release it, it flew into her parakeet cage and began looking at itself in the mirror. It made a variety of vocalizations, raised and lowered its crest, wiggled back and forth. In fact, it liked the mirror so much that it would refuse to leave the cage except to come out for food. By the way, the parakeet hated this. Every time the cedar waxwing would fly into the cage, it would fly out. I think that she had this cage on her screened in porch or something like that. So she would just kind of open the parakeet cage, let the parakeet kind of, get some yard time out of its cage. And, the waxwing just loved this mirror that she had in the parakeet cage, kind of as a toy for the parakeet. Eventually, Edith had to make a separate cage with mirrors in it for the waxwing to use. She kept the door of this cage open and outside so that the waxwing was free to come and go and look at its reflection as it pleased. There wasn't really an ending to this story. She just kind of wrote down this anecdote that I read. So I don't know if the waxwing just kept coming back to this over time, or if it eventually, wandered off, joined its flock. All right, so let's wrap up with evolution and taxonomy, as I usually do. So before I focus on the evolution of these birds, let me touch a bit on how plants evolved alongside these birds. Many plants, especially the berry-producing plants, rely heavily on birds to spread their seeds. In fact, some have evolved to rely on partial digestion by birds in order to germinate. Red cedar seeds that pass through cedar waxwing digestive tracts have about double the chance of germinating compared to ones that just fall off the tree. This is also similar for mistletoe and apple seeds, which rely on having their outer layer removed by animals' intestines in order to be able to germinate. This is so cool. We think about, seeds just, kind of being there, they fall off the tree and then they sprout, but, they really rely on animals to eat them and digest them in order for them to be able to germinate, which is really cool. And sort of gross. They want to get pooped out in order to grow. Mistletoe, it's kind of like a semi-parasitic plant. It grows up in the branches of other trees, and it literally relies on birds shitting it out onto other tree branches. If you know how to look for mistletoe, it's way up in the canopy of trees. You're like, how the hell did that get there? Well, because a bird was perched on that branch and shit out a seed, and, its shit clung to the branch, and so that the seed was able to grow. So I got sort of a short evolution section here, and that's because the placement of waxwings in the avian tree has been a bit of a conundrum for taxonomists, even with the advent of genomic testing. Based on their appearance, they were paired up with the silky flycatchers, a very small group of New World birds that contains the difficult-to-pronounce Phainopepla, a sort of black cardinal-looking bird that inhabits the American Southwest and Mexico. Egg white protein analysis has confirmed this relationship between waxwings and silky flycatchers. The only paper I could find doing genetic research on waxwings and their allies was conducted in 2009, and here's what it found. Basically, waxwings belong to a wider clade called Bombycillid. This clade is within a paraorder called Muscicapidae that contains a few sister clades such as the Muscicapoidae, contains a diverse group of birds such as mockingbirds, starlings, and dippers. There's another sister clade in that called Cirthioidae that contains nuthatches, wrens, and creepers. So this paraorder, the Muscicapidae, it likely has Gondwanan origins, specifically in Australia, where they likely colonized Eurasia around 27 million years ago. It's impossible with the little research available to make remarks on the exact evolutionary history of Bombycillid,
But as you guys know, that doesn't keep me from making assumptions. So, you know, this study from 2009 I talked about, it did have some pretty interesting findings. Two birds, the gray hypocoleus and olive-flanked whistler, appear to have close relation to the bombacillid clade. This is interesting because these birds had previously belonged to different taxonomic groups. The gray hypocoleus isn't much of a surprise. It's definitely related once you look at it. You know, it has a similar body type and dietary preference to our waxwings. It's basically like the Middle East counterpart. It likes fruit. It looks very similar with that black facial, you know, mask and everything like that. The olive-flanked whistler is pretty surprising, though, because it's confined solely to the mountains of the Indonesian island of Sulawesi. This is so cool because, I mean, basically this bird is like an isolated holdover from when the clade was first diversifying and leaving Australia and colonizing, you know, the mainland of Europe and Asia. The bombacillid order also contains a bird called the palmchat. This is a small songbird with a down-curved bill. It almost looks similar to a thrush that inhabits the island of Hispaniola that has the Dominican Republic and Haiti. So, you know, how do these birds relate to each other? Well, at least according to that 2009 study, the palmchat actually appears to be the most distantly related or basal member of the bombacillid clade, which doesn't really make sense. I mean, you know, these originated in, in Australia, you know, and spread to, you know, Europe and Asia. How the hell did, like, kind of the most basal member, you know, end up in Haiti? So I don't know if this is just a consequence of the shaky genetic inference or, like, the earliest ancestor of bombacillid, you know, was pretty widespread, you know, made it to Haiti, and then just all its, like, close relatives, you know, died off or got replaced by other species. But anyway, next comes our lonely island olive-flanked whistler that appears to have split off from the other bombacillid common ancestors around 20 million years ago. You know, this kind of makes sense. You know, they were leaving Australia. Indonesia's pretty close by. It set up on an island and hung out. As the bombacillid clade spread across Europe and Asia, the gray hypocoleus ancestor stuck around the Middle East and became an arid environmental specialist, while the ancestors of the waxwings and silky flycatchers took on a more holarctic distribution in the northern hemisphere. This led to their common ancestor likely crossing the Bering Strait and making it all the way down to the deserts of the American Southwest, where it became the silky flycatcher group. The waxwing ancestor remained in the northern hemisphere, forming three species. There are some wood frogs. Well, the frogs and toads seem to definitely have liked all the rain we had recently. Interestingly, the cedar waxwing appears to have formed first in the waxwing group. Likely, it split from a separate colonization event in America from the silky flycatchers. Like, probably the common ancestor of silky flycatchers and waxwings, you know, it went across, it made it down to the American Southwest and kind of differentiated, formed its own species. And then the waxwing common ancestor of all three species was hanging out in the whole Arctic, you know, area, the northern hemisphere of Europe and Asia, then made it across again, across the Bering, you know, land bridge, Beringia, and formed our cedar waxwing. And the Japanese waxwing and the Bohemian waxwings are the most recent split. The tricky thing with these birds is the Bohemian waxwing kind of commingles with all of them. You know, it has a American distribution it overlaps with the distribution of the Japanese waxwing. They all flock together, so it's kind of hard to figure out, like, why do they speciate. You know, from what I can figure, it's probably due to some of the glaciation events that have happened in the, you know, past hundreds of thousands of years, that they probably formed kind of three separate populations and speciated then. And by the time the glaciers receded and they were able to commingle again, they had already diverged so much that they don't interbreed. Anyway, you know, like I said, there's not a lot of research here. There was also an article from 2019 that did like a really big genomic analysis of a lot of birds. And it suggested that the honey creepers of Hawaii have some kind of relationship to the bombacillid clade. I didn't really dive into that. Maybe if I do a Hawaiian birds episode or something, I'll talk about that more. But I didn't really know what to make of it, I'll be honest. I read the article. I was like, I don't know. This is a bit over my head. So anyway, a bit of a scatterbrained evolutionary section. I was working with scraps, people. I'm sorry. But I hope you liked this episode. It was sort of interesting to record this with all the rain coming down in the beginning. And, you know, now it's pretty nice out. Lots of bird noise. It's been great. I have a great time recording and researching these episodes. I hope you guys like it too. Please share the Dirty Bird love. Let me know if you want some free stickers. I'm happy to mail you some. Please leave reviews. Please write in. And as always, stay dirty, fellow birdies.
Dirty Bird Podcast is brought to you by me, John, with my rotating panel of guests and co-hosts. Thanks for being on the show, everybody. The Dirty Bird theme song is by Ricky Pistone. Check out his groovy and hilarious music videos on YouTube. The outro music you're listening to right now is a song, New York Redneck, by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music. The Dirty Bird Podcast logo is by the very talented TJ Ranosky. And of course, a shout out to my beautiful wife, Lauren, who created my original logo. Check out the show notes for this episode for a full list of credits for any bird calls or sounds used in the episode. Thanks for listening.
In the back, and I like the New York Mets and my cowboy hat.